Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jennifer Foudy, Executive Director of the Kuali Foundation, convening this session. I'd like to introduce our two speakers. Many of you already know these folks. Shel Wagner, Associate Vice Chancellor and CIO at UCal Berkeley, and Brad Wheeler, Vice President for IT and CIO at Indiana. And you may have read approximately 2 years ago a paper that they published in one of the EDUCAUSE publications and beyond about the above campus services. And so today we're very excited because we're going to hear 2 years later how they see where we stand after a couple of years. So with that, I will turn it directly over to them.
Thank you, Jennifer. Let's see if we got the mic up loud enough here. Can you hear me okay?
No.
Testing this. All right, here we go. 2 years ago, actually it was 3 years ago, when Brad and I were meeting with a number of colleagues and talking about the shift to services from products. We weren't talking about the cloud. We were talking about what this really means to all of us when you start thinking about how you're going to acquire services, provision services, distribute services, when it's no longer about buying the box or buying the shrink wrap or buying product, or in fact, the delivery models for those things. How's that going to impact higher ed? And there were a lot of areas we saw opportunities, but a lot of challenges along the way. And I think it was over one of those conversations, and probably with a beverage in a hand, that Brad said, you know, the problem is that there are some fundamental things that we as a community have to begin to do if we're going to shape the market. Otherwise, we're going to sit back. And higher ed is known to adopt many things very quickly in small ways, only to find out later on that we miss the opportunity to influence the market. We basically are downstream, and we shouldn't be, because many of these things are happening upstream. Now, Brad, is your recollection similar to that as to how we got started?
It was about like that. We had a meeting in Boulder. There was a group, and we had a conversation, and there was a follow-up with Common Solutions Group in May. And the ideas really started gelling from there, and under the tutelage and whip of Teddy Diggs, an article appeared a few months later.
So when we got started with this, you know, we said, all right, what are the big things that we need to really be concerning ourselves with? And it wasn't about, you know, whether Amazon was going to be able to offer the services effectively for our community. We knew that the market was going to develop quickly. Now, it's hard to remember, but in late 2007, early 2008, I had meetings with the folks up at Amazon, and Jeff Bezos came in and said, hey, we have this idea. We think we're going to do this. You know, that was only a few years ago, right? They're now running services for hundreds of thousands of small and medium businesses. So the time scale these things are happening on dwarfs what has come before us, right? So then what are the things that we really needed to look at? And if you go back and you read that article, Brad was a great writer, by the way. I liked rereading it again recently. There were four areas which we felt that the community needed to influence, that you individually as leaders and the IT community need to take stock of and we needed to look at. So we provided a status report on this last year, and so here we are 2 years later to say, how are things going? You know, what else do we need to be looking at? So we hope to have a discussion today. There are a couple of mics out there, but you know, it's a small audience, so feel free to yell out if you have questions for us. But these four areas, you know, recognizing that identity was going to be key. Regardless of the service in question, identity was going to matter, as many of the commercial providers at the time knew. The question of consortium maker, how were we going to aggregate demand in a way that could influence the market? Right? Then what about our teams, the staff that are providing all our services in-house? What strengths do we bring to the table? What challenges are we going to have? What do we need to retain and retool on? And then finally, the question of policy, not just in our own space, but elsewhere in the institution. Policies on procurement or policies on access, privacy, security. So those were the four big domains.
I might just add, that term above campus sounds kind of strange. Like, where did that come from? Shel and I have both done a lot of work with private sector, particularly big global firms, multinational firms, and they think about what they do in their end market, in the market of, you know, in Chile or in Brazil or in South Africa. And there are some things that need to be done locally in those markets, but there are some things that they aggregate above market that they do on a global basis. And so that's where that term came from. Was instead of above market, we called it above campus?
In the case of the argument at the time, many of our colleagues said to us that it was interesting, but it wasn't something that we needed to be as active in, that it would develop over a period of time and we could kind of watch as it went. I put this quote up there only in that it is not only a question of, you know, when was this going to happen. For Brad and I, it wasn't even a when. 3 years ago, we believed it was now at that time. We were quite passionate around the fact that if we didn't get a strategy as a community, not individually, that we were really going to miss out. And I will tell you, if you look at the stock prices of the commercial providers in this space, right, I am very thankful that we were right. Mr. Benanoff gave $100 million to a new hospital at UC San Francisco, thanks to us being right. I mean, the model is moving very quickly, and they recognize these three trends, which we recognized at the time as well, and that we need to be influencing. And what I find most interesting about all three, right, cloud as a general concept, mobility, and social, is it pretty much describes higher ed, right? We are where the commercial world is trying to move to. We just don't recognize it. The fact that we are chaotic in our entities. We have people coming and going all of the time. We're dispersed. Even when you have a central campus, you have people working for that campus all over the place. We've got researchers and students that travel on a daily basis. Social is all about, Mr. Zuckerberg didn't start at Procter & Gamble, right? All of these things are higher ed. And so the world is actually moving to us, not the other way around. So why we would sit back and let the world commercial side define how we're going to engage with them is just not going to be a strategy that we'll be successful in. We have to turn that model around. So let's start with identity. Those of you that have been involved in the identity wars for years, they continue unabated. The Liberty Alliance, everybody remembers Microsoft's outstanding passport program and how well received that was. Currently you've got the Google ID and the Facebook ID battle royale going on. So every one of you in this audience, is there anybody, we'll do it the other way around, anybody in the audience has never logged in using one of these IDs? Is there anybody here? I wanted to know where your Sanskrit tablets were if that was the case. But in fact, this battle is raging on a day-to-day basis. And it is not raging for your benefit. It is raging for the benefit of the entities that are providing those IDs, because they understand that if they control the access point, then they control the information and the metadata, and they can position things for you. Well, we believe the only people that should be positioning things for you are you and our own community, not a commercial provider. Not that those don't have advantages and various opportunities, but this is where federated identity comes into place. So our community was fortunate that a number of years ago, Internet2 sponsored from the work that was being done in the middleware community the creation of InCommon. InCommon is a federated identity solution that takes the identities that you have at your institution and makes them a value beyond your walls, right? Federates who you are, the assertion that Brad is who he says he is, and then he can use services that are provided elsewhere.
As an EDUCAUSE, by the way, if your institution is already in this, when you go to the EDUCAUSE website, you know you can log in with your home institution credentials and not have to do a password reset every time you go to the EDUCAUSE website.
But it's not just about passwords. We all think of it as single sign-on, mm-hmm. right? And that's where the ease of benefit comes in. If you don't have to, if you don't have to sign in again, that's great. But actually, it's about all the data about you that really matters. So at your institution, they know whether you're a faculty or a staff or a student, right? They know whether you're supposed to have access to journals in the library or whether you should have a card key that lets you into a building. They have information that's relevant to you. Well, those are the roles. That's what you get to do. So when you start thinking beyond just who you are and the password that you have to assert who you are, and you start thinking about what you can do, it gets to be incredibly powerful. So InCommon says that we don't know what you want to be able to do, but you know. So at Indiana, if they want to have a course that they want to expose to anybody else in the CIC. They don't have to go through a huge effort to figure out how do we let a Northwestern student look at one of our courses if we don't want to let somebody from another institution look. Maybe there's just a relationship between those two entities. Well, within Common, Northwestern is federated, Indiana is federated. You just log in with your Northwestern credentials, and you're in. So this federation, this web of webs, is how we work already, and this is facilitating it. Now, you can see the growth curve here. I apologize that I don't have the 2011 number up there. It's grown by about 100.
And I would say this is one of the most important things. If your institution is not in Common, you know, leave the session now and go get on the phone and start doing the paperwork, whatever you need to do. This is one of the most important first steps if your institution has not taken it.
It's absolutely foundational. And you will find that the vendors in the broader commercial community are beginning to migrate here as well. We have 84 commercial providers who are part of InCommon. Anybody have Turnitin.com at your institution?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you log into Turnitin.com, if you're an InCommon member, the student logs in using their campus ID. The campus had to do no work to make that happen at all. Turnitin.com accepts federated identity, accepts assertions from our campuses, allows a student to turn it in directly to Turnitin.com. More importantly, if your institution decides to change from Turnitin.com to another provider, there's no impact to the students. There is no impact to the faculty. They'll still use the credentials they've always been using. You just make the relationship available to the second provider, and you are no longer captive with the fact that everybody has accounts and everybody has roles at Turnitin. Those are managed by your institution. You can migrate them at the flip of a switch. So it gives you freedom without impacting your end users. Now, there is work up front. I had a conversation with a potential InCommon school who said to me, "You mean we have to know who we are giving IDs to?" And I said, "Yeah, that would be a good idea." So, you know, there are some responsibilities your institution have. If somebody can walk up and get an ID in your institution and become a .edu member, then you're going to have some trouble because you have to be able to assert that you actually know who that person is and they're supposed to be part of your community. But otherwise, the rules are pretty lightweight. And it costs, for a smaller institution, it costs a whopping $1,100 to join InCommon. Right? So this is not a major financial burden for anybody. Although Brad and I have to pay $3,000 being the large institutions. But it's really more about the foundational element, getting that in place so we can start to leverage each other. So that's it on the federated identity.
We spoke yesterday in a session about demand aggregation. Those of you who are on the EDUCAUSE CIO list know over the summer there were several things posted, like what's your cost to, you know, buy bandwidth? And people reported some of their costs, and they vary greatly in the cost to institutions. And someone chimed in and said they've got some concerns on ERP maintenance costs. Someone else said, you know, there's the mergers in the software space. We're not sure that's good for us. And so we kind of summed all this up in saying, you know, there's a lot of things going on, as Shell and I talked about earlier on. There's a lot of things happening on the sell side. The sell side's pursuing its interest in doing what it's supposed to do. That's the way our world's organized, and they're doing good stuff for their interest. But the question is, what are we doing on the buy side? Are we taking care of our interest and looking at it from a chessboard mentality? So in the article, we asserted, and we're now seeing, the next slide will reveal, that there were probably three paths to demand aggregation that would help us rebalance this buy-sell relationship in the marketplace some. The first path was the commercial sector wants to take it on, and we can give it to them, and we can just thank God for it. Student email, off to Google or Microsoft, love you, gone. You know, just pass it to the commercial sector, and that works for us, and that's great. And there's a number of things that we may just do that with. The second one is that we need a consortium maker. We need an aggregator amongst us, and it might be regional, it might be clubs like the CIC, the Big Ten, and the University of Chicago. It might be EDUCAUSE, it might be Internet too. We didn't know who the aggregator was going to be, but we know we needed an aggregator to try to get some scale. Or the third path may be that one of our institutions is particularly good at doing something, And so that institution becomes a service provider, and people help by contract underwrite the cost of doing that. We have several places where that's going on. So those are the three things we proffered, and this is a two-year report, and I think we've got some good things to show in the community.
So building on the strength of In Common was one of the foundations that we looked at. And Internet 2 has found now that through the support of its members, we are beginning to add additional services beyond identity. So the first one was certificate services. All of you have certificates for your individual machines. You have SSL certs, wildcard certs, personal certs. We've been paying for those in the commercial market more or less one-off. Each campus, I was seeing huge aggregation at Berkeley. We were buying 10 at a time. Right? Hundreds of, or thousands of certs all across Berkeley. Well, we got together as a community and said, there's a better way. We didn't just go try to buy those certs in bulk as a community. We went to the cert providers and said, let's do this differently. How can we get administrative interfaces at our campus so that we can handle distribution of certificates? How can we get an all-you-can-eat price so we don't have to have the administrative overhead of trying to count the number of certificates? So it was really the offering was a big part of it. As a result, we worked with a number of vendors. A vendor stepped up. And in the case of every subscriber thus far, they have saved somewhere between 10 and 70% on what they were spending before for unlimited number of certs now versus the individual certs they were buying before. And we've yet begun to scratch the surface of the benefit here because now, for example, at Berkeley, I can now issue an individual cert to every single member of my community. So they can have a personal cert for their email, for their other services, for all students, all faculty, all staff, and it costs me no more because I have a single administrative interface and access to it. So that was an example where we were able to bring that into very fine detail, just getting a small enough group together to work well, but large enough that we brought enough scale to the table to say what are the differences. We now have 131, says the head of In Common, Jack Seuss. And that just is growing every day because it's so easy to use. It's really an enormous benefit. So if you get into In Common and then you want to add certificates, you can do it at lower cost than what you're spending today. And in some cases, dramatically lower costs.
Yeah, I want to connect this to the academic mission. It's easy to think about cert and logins and credentials as kind of geeky stuff, but think of this as creating a better canvas on which your faculty and deans can innovate. If we want to do degree programs that are multi-institutional, right now that is really, really hard. Which learning management system? Can they use the library? There's many, many things. The SIS integration piece may be a bit more of a challenge, but by having federated identity, we can enable our faculty and deans and others to create multi-institution degree programs where they do have some interest, particularly in courses and majors where it is hard to generate sufficient scale on your own. So we could spend a lot of time on this, but this is not just geeky stuff. This is about above-campus services in terms of the academy, not just in terms of technology.
And without going into the exciting futures, one of the things to consider is how does this change when you can give a certificate to every one of your students that they can install on their mobile devices? And they have a second factor authentication of a certificate available to them. The opportunities here are enormous. We are really at an exciting inflection point. And my thanks to all of the team that put this together and the people in Common that have worked so hard over the years, because now we're starting to see the benefits. So one of those is in the form of this next service, the HP SHI offering. So 15 campuses are started, and we had 13 early adopter research campuses who said the same thing, not about personal services, but about institutional services. We're all dying from delivering electricity. Lots of people think of it as storage and computing, but when you see the electrical bill, you realize what we're really delivering. The cost of computation is getting to be cheaper and cheaper, and the cost of electricity is going the other way. So we're building new data centers, server farms, environments for our researchers. Well, we can't keep up. The trajectory is astounding. So we know we're going to need to be acquiring services from other places. So how do we do this? Well, we met with HP, And we said, how can you build an offering for higher ed that's not a public cloud like just like Amazon? We know we can go get that. But what if we want something that we're sharing with each other within our community? How can we build a community cloud? And so HP had designed a very robust, high available cloud offering that they built for SHI. SHI is a common provider to higher ed, and they actually have a large presence in other markets. And we now have 5-6 use cases in production on a community cloud within HP that's accessible directly through Internet 2, using your in-common credentials, so you can activate an instance like that. You can log in and create an instance of a cluster or an individual server that is appearing on your network. Right? So it starts to change the economics of what it means to build high-performance computing. And there are other examples of this, but this one through Internet 2 is an example where the community came together to design a community solution instead of just, again, letting the private sector offer single proprietary solutions to Berkeley or to Indiana or to MIT or to others, or we just go use it as a consumer in the consumer cloud.
I think everybody knows, too, if you're buying cycles and storage out there in the cloud, the transport charges are some of the largest component of doing that. Well, as a community with Internet 2, you know, we own what, when it's fully lit up, will be an 8-terabit network. Why don't we take our own pipes with our own pieces? And that's what Shell's been able to negotiate with Internet 2 and HP and SHI.
So that capacity, I mean, if you want to talk about aggregating demand, you know, the 1996 meeting that created Internet 2, 30 university CIOs getting together and saying, you know, our own destiny is going to be based on our ability to share between each other for research. We're going to need to have the network to do that. So this is an evolution now and an accelerating evolution of what was started in the basement of the Hyatt all those years ago.
The Hilton.
Which one was it? Was it the Hyatt?
The Chicago Hilton.
Oh, right. Every time I go to O'Hare, I try to leave as quickly as I can, so I don't necessarily remember. The next service is another commercial offering that many universities are already using. You may not realize you're using it, but your students are using it. Things like Dropbox, Box.net, file sharing services, SugarSync, there's a number of them out there. They all have pros and cons. The question is, how do you make an institutional offering out of it? Well, here's an interesting secret given to you directly from someone who has sat at the table with Silicon Valley companies. They don't like higher ed. You're very hard to sell to.
That would be are very hard to sell to.
Oh, is it we?
Yes,
okay.
Us too.
We. Somebody came up to me after a meeting earlier and said, wait, you're at Berkeley? Do you know how long it took me to sell to Berkeley? We are the sales cycle into higher ed is so long. Right? And then the margins are so small. Right? That in the end, is it really worth the effort? So the cost of sales for us is very, very high. Our unique requirements are very high. The end margins are very low. That doesn't make for a good demand aggregation. So in addition to finding ways to aggregate our need, we need to change the way we engage with the providers. So Internet 2 has been working with Box.net to offer a service. Box is one of the many application storage platforms out there in the market that allows you to have personalized storage spaces for collaboration. Well, what is collaboration? Collaboration is, again, higher ed. That's what we do. So instead of Box just trying to sell to each one of us, a group of CIOs got together, iteratively said, let's get best in class, not perfect, but a good starting point. Let's work with Box to figure out how we can create an offering. And schools like Michigan and Illinois, Notre Dame, Berkeley got together and said, we'll find a way to work with Box and get an offering in place. And as a result, Box customized a solution for higher ed with one contract between Box and Internet 2. And then for every in common member, you'll be able to access the service directly with your in common credentials, log in, sign up, get a Box account, not as an individual, but as a whole institution. And in doing so, you'll get all the benefits of Box's enterprise solution, which comes with security logging and validation services and provisioning services and a whole bunch of great tools at a fraction of the price that you ever could as a commercial customer, but much more service than you would if you were just an individual and you got their free consumer offering.
I mean, so think about where this really goes to what Shell has said. At Indiana University, we have a policy that says don't put administrative data in places that we're a little nervous about. It's possible someone in Indiana is doing that right now with various consumer offerings out there. So you can pretend that's not happening, or you can give them a solution negotiated this way that does all the things that they need to do and has identity. They need to share a file with another colleague. It's the email address that we already have in our identity systems. The second thing I want to point out about this, and Shell didn't say this, but what we learned in going through and getting this contract done from Shell's first meeting with Box.net to rounding up the launch universities that would sign on, the Internet 2 deals, the master agreement, signed 62 days from first meeting to done. And it was announced at the Internet 2 meeting a couple weeks ago. The launch universities are lighting up over the next month or so, and it will be general availability
January
to Internet 2 members. That is a new style of us working together at scale, getting things done. And Shell will tell you, you know, where the Box people felt like the price point ought to be and where Shell felt like the price point ought to be, that was a considerable conversation to our interest. And, you know, every time he would send something around, and it was a long discussion, folks. I mean, even in that compressed time, the legal issues, is it secure, how will identity, what if Box is sold? I mean, you can imagine all the questions you go through. And, you know, he would send them around on the list, and I would just say, Indiana's in, go, go, go. Indiana's in, go, go. And we were able to nail it.
Well, we had eight schools and everybody contributing intellectual property in the form of all of your brain power to say, how do we get this going quickly? And as a result, we got it going quickly. And the customized offering is really going to be incredibly helpful for us as we start thinking about working with more and more providers who all of you have those phone calls coming into you every day. So all we did was say, we need this solution. If we need it, others need it. If others need it, then let's get a coalition of the willing together and get it done once and then make it available to everybody. And that's what Net Plus is all about.
And our first use case at Indiana University will be providing it to our trustees for their file sharing at board books.
So if you haven't used it, you can log in and get a free account at box.net. And then when your institution signs up, they'll just sweep all those and put them under the advanced services for Box. So that's it on the demand aggregation and some of the progress over the last 2 years or in the last year. The next area really is about staff. So we all think of our staffs as, you know, as outstanding, right? They're unbelievable contributors. They work terribly hard. They do everything for our institutions. But, you know, everybody has something to learn. And one of the challenges that we're seeing in this, you know, if you think about all your IT staff, how do they deliver services and how do they provide things? Well, you know, it's getting to be quite a bit different than it used to be. You know, in the old days, you know, they were in charge or they were the control mechanism. They would be the ones to evaluate whether it was secure or not. They'd be the ones to install it. They would be the ones to configure it. They would be the ones to allow access to it. They would tune it. They would do all of the work, soup to nuts, in every layer of the stack. And then all of a sudden, stuff started popping up all over the place where, you know, they didn't really need to do it. You don't have to sign a Google agreement for all your students to be using Google, right? Everybody is starting to use these things. What about open source solutions like Moodle? Well, then there's Moodle Rooms. Is that a commercial solution or an open source solution? We're going to install Sakai. Are we installing Sakai? Are we getting it as a cloud-hosted offering? You know, the whole world is changing, and changing very fast. And I would submit that for all of us in the room who are working hard to understand the trends and the trajectories, your staff are as well, but that's in the 0.5% of brain power they have left at the end of the day when they just work 12 hours to keep everything running. And so we need to be thinking about how we can support them. And it's not an easy thing, particularly when you look at what's coming next, right? Okay, 580 venture capital firms that are going to provide software as a service solutions to your community. Many of these were started by your students, so don't blame anybody else. So, you know, the question is, what are you going to do for your teams, and what are we doing collectively for our teams? We wrote about the need to begin thinking about this differently 2 years ago. And I would say that we have done less in a coordinated way here than we should have. You know, this is the softer side on the IT equation. You know, all these skills that our teams have. I mean, and I'll put some of the Berkeley team up against anybody, public, private, commercial, in terms of their technical skills. But are they evolving and adapting fast enough? I don't think anybody is. So what are we doing to reinforce and support that? It's a real challenge.
I mean, to Shell's point, even with the HP SHI deal going through with Internet 2, Net Plus, and the box one, on the list, I mean, there were the conversations at the launch institutions. You know, the staff go, well, you know, our cost of buying hardware and drives, we could stand up that service. What's the real cost per, you know, megabyte and such? And you go, you are never going to be able to write the consumer interface to the variety of devices as fast as they are evolving as somebody who's running this for hundreds of industries at scale. It's not just about the cost of hardware or we pay less for labor. It is thinking differently. So we had several rounds of those conversations amongst the launch institutions.
And one of the arguments that I've been making with that community, both my peers in other institutions and all of their senior leadership, is it isn't about who's best. It's about who moves fastest. That's the world we're moving to. And you know, higher ed, not so much, right? We are conservators of information. We are preservationists of knowledge. For eons, that has been our role. So how do you adapt to a world where, you know, this box relationship is great, and it took us 60 days to get in place, and we'll have it in production for these schools, and everybody will get using it. But you know what? I have no illusion that 2 years from now, there's going to be a better widget out there. But if I build Box in-house and run it in-house, it may be better than Box is today, right now. But I'm pretty sure I'd still be running it 3 years after a better alternative came along. Because the ability for me to spin something up, deploy it, maintain it with the skills that I have in-house today, and then tell those folks, okay, we got to change on a dime, we're gonna sunset that one and move to another one, is just not there. It's not in the muscle memory yet. So I don't think this is the team's fault in any way.
No.
The onus is entirely on the CIOs here and the senior leadership of IT to say we've got to be thinking about how we promote change in our staff more. What are the skills and the training?
And on the staff, it's not only us, but this is a whole different way of procurement. The way your institution comes into the Box.net deal is through Internet 2. I mean, many of you are already members of Internet 2 one way or another. You'll be able to, you know, check a box. How many students do I have? What volume am I buying at? There is going to be a member agreement between you and Internet 2, but it's not negotiating with Box. It's simple. You're already paying dues to Internet 2. Does your procurement office know how to do that? Is that all okay? Hopefully it's seen as a membership and not someone that says, oh, my gosh, now we have to run a whole nother, you know, bid cycle. So staff evolution is not only our own technical staff. It may be our general counsel's office. It may be our procurement officers as well.
So when you think about your team, you know, I would just ask you to look at, you know, the job descriptions that you're currently operating under. Take those job descriptions, do a quick scan of Dice or Google or Monster. I'm guessing they're not the dominant job descriptions that are out there in the market today. Right? Our job descriptions are atrophying because the world is changing very quickly. We need to be training our teams up to take on new roles and new responsibilities. And you need to be thinking about that. You need to be thinking about the training programs. How many people are you sending to the same training programs that you sent them to a few years ago? Maybe the certification name has changed. Maybe the specific technology has changed. But if you're still sending them, if you're spending the majority of your app development training moving from, you know, Java to Ruby to PHP or PHP to, you know, if that's where your dollars are going, what percentage of that have you carved out for people to do security and services evaluation for web services with third parties? Right? Those same skills that they use as developers, they can morph to be outstanding integration engineers, but only if you're starting to have them think that that's a value-added service. If they don't think it's value add and they're not going to have the opportunity for career growth in your organizations unless they move to the pinnacle of development or the pinnacle of system administration, then you're going to run into problems in the coming years or 3 years ago and now, right? I mean, it's happening pretty quickly. Okay. Next on our parade of four areas, we had identity, we had aggregation, we had staff development and training, and we have policy. Yeah. So Jack is talking about one of the regional networks in Michigan offering service in the form of this kind of training to all of their members collectively. Collectively, rather than each of us trying to do it one-off. Right? We're seeing, I think it's out of Georgia Tech, where they have an evaluation program on evaluating the quality of your services. And that's been opened up to other institutions. There's more of this happening. I would argue that it isn't happening fast enough to keep up with the pace of change that we're seeing in the market.
But the key point here, in the gestalt of everything we're saying, many of the solutions for this decade, the foreseeable decade, are aggregation. They are together. They are above campus. We have a brilliant network to do it. We have a millennium-refined culture for sharing. But frankly, we're not moving at the pace the world is changing around us. We're still, you walk through the exhibit hall here, you listen to the conversations, what you still frequently hear is, my campus as an island and we did this, or, oh, what did you do, looking through a periscope, oh, we might imitate you, but there still is this notion of such individual steps by our campuses, and that's just not what I think is the economic winning equation for the decade.
Well, particularly now, I mean, Google does not come to you and say, let me install and customize an email solution on your campus for you. Because it's a service, right? That's how they get to the scale they're getting at. And we have that scale ourselves.
Sheldon talked about this. We need a greater sense of urgency in higher ed that is summed up in the phrase of, if we do not hang together, we shall surely hang separately. That's the way the world is changing around us, and it is going to take doing more of the kinds of things that Jack talked about, the Net Plus services from Internet 2 and a variety of these points on the soft skills as well as the contracts.
So in my personal favorite area, policy, because I love dealing with Washington so much and the state of California, this is an area where I will say we have some real advanced thinking going on and some real retrograde thinking going on. When Brad and I first presented this paper and talked about this several years ago, I can't tell you the number of back-channel conversations that went on saying, well, we're not going to give away all our data to the rest of the world. We're not going to, it's not going to be secure. It's not going to be private. It's not going to have the things. It's all about what it wouldn't be instead of making it what we want it to be. We need to be changing our policies. We have the power in the market, and we have the power amongst ourselves with not a lot of extra effort to shift things. But we really weren't ready for the cloud. Many of our policies, our procurement processes, our privacy statements just weren't recognizing the reality of where we are. And so you really need to be putting some energy into this as well. And I don't think, we can say that we've had the progress here that we would like, but we have seen some real promising trends. I mean, EDUCAL's whole policy approach is being reworked. They're making real progress there. Susan Graycheck came in, and the core data survey is going to look nothing like it did a few years ago. Just like we need new training, we need new ways to look at the data, our data, right? And these data are so critical to us to be able to influence our policies, right? You don't write policies in a vacuum, and you don't write them by emotion, right? You write them by data. The cloud first at the federal level, right? So there is actually a federal policy in place at the White House that says cloud first. We're going to look at how the federal government can move up the stack and aggregate things. Now, that doesn't mean it happens quickly, federal government quickly, not necessarily. they make higher ed look quite speedy, but, things are happening there. Now, NSF and NIH on their funding models are still somewhat retrograde. You know, there's still places where you have to list the kind of hardware you're buying on your capital grant from NSF. You know, when was the last time, you know, you bought hardware when you needed storage? Well, most of the time at your institutions now, somebody's buying the hardware, but it's just storage you're getting. Well, that's true at the higher level as well. So these models are changing. Some areas we've made a lot of progress. Other areas we haven't. The RFP process.
Yeah, you know, I'm a business school professor. It continues to baffle me. Why do we only respond to offers to sell? Why do we not more frequently assert how we wish to buy? You know, if you want good giggles, sit down with your procurement officer and say, you know, you want to run a process that says, I'm willing to acquire this, this, and this thing, and I'm willing to pay this for it, and the terms are to be X, Y, and Z. And you're going to put that out and just see who makes an offer, and even lower bids will be accepted. But rather than them establishing how they want to sell, us asserting how we want to buy. The net plus deals, that was two cases of us asserting how we want to buy. And I think that is going to be a very powerful force that we need to take greater advantage of in rebalancing the chessboard for this decade.
And it just doesn't work individually. You can't get the attention that you need. But I will tell you who does this reasonably well. Capital Projects. They build a plan, they say what they need, they have a bidders conference, and they say, all right, who's going to do this for me? We need to be able to have those same conversations. It isn't that there isn't a lot of commercial talent out there that we can leverage, but if we passively sit back and then one-on-one say, well, we would like this and we would like that, and check boxes. This last point is really key. The only way we finally got Google's attention was thanks to the folks at NFP. And they had to sue us to get Google to do it, right? So if our providers are not providing tools that are fully accessible, the only way they're going to do that is if the market tells them to do it. And the only way the market's going to tell them to do it is not through legislation. It's through us demanding it. We didn't need legislation to tell us the right thing to do is to make our environments available to everybody in our community. It's nice that we have it now because it's a reinforcement statement. But we need to get this more inculcated into the overall process. So I'd like to have seen more progress there, and I would have liked to have been up here today 2 years later saying how much progress we've made on the policy side, and that, you know what, we were able to avoid legislation or suits from NFB, but, you know, sometimes that's what it takes. So those are our four big areas of update. I think, you know, the question is, what's next? I mean, what are you seeing in your communities in this above the campus? Where are you collaborating? We heard from Jack that there's training now going on with some of the regionals. I heard an interesting project that was being discussed earlier today around offering individual modules of a course for sharing between campuses as opposed to a course, right? So how do we do that? I mean, you brought that up. How exactly would you do that? If I want to get one lecture to be integrated into my curriculum from Indiana, how would I do that today? Well, the thought processes haven't really been there. But some of the things are starting to be in place. Well, if they can just log into Indiana's lecture capture system using Berkeley credentials for that one course, and I could share using groups, I could share the group data of who's in my class with Indiana so that they could automatically then expose that course to that section at Berkeley. You know, there's some of those things that we're starting to
Two of the IU librarians just fainted that are in the audience in terms of the policy compliance there with our licensing with the publishers.
But oh, Elsevier will be fine. They'll be fine. Don't worry.
We're going to work through that. Jack has a comment. Just make sure the folks in the video can hear. Jack's noting that we all have support needs, knowledge base, answers to our community. There's a session later today about leverage and shared support using the network, because that's another great economic opportunity for above-campus services. Other questions and comments about, you know, what we can do, what are the opportunities to go faster?
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Trappler from UCLA. I was at the Internet 2 session earlier this morning, and one of the slides they showed was some of the new members and some of the industry members, and one of the industry members was VMware. In the software licensing group, there are groups in out of UK and Australia that bring together higher ed for their entire nations. I'm wondering, do you think Internet 2 could serve that role for traditional software type agreements? I'm thinking about VMware as a prime example, because I've been talking to a lot of folks here struggling to get good agreements with VMware, but that would just be one example.
Well, his badge says Indiana and mine says Berkeley, so we'll speak for Internet 2 and say, I sure hope so. I mean, I you know, at this point, it's going to be less and less about the product by terms and conditions than it is about the services acquisition terms and conditions, and that's where Internet 2 knows how to do it, right? So then it's a matter of us as members bringing those things to Internet 2. There's an email address in Internet 2, netplus, N-E-T-P-L-U-S. You can send these ideas into those folks, and Jerry Grochow, the former CIO at MIT, is currently leading up that group, and you know, they're getting a lot of interest and ideas from the members saying, hey, you know, we could really make a difference if we could do this or that. And it's not about, you know, VMware is not doing anything you wouldn't do if you were in their shoes. But I'm telling you, if you could find a way to make their life easier where they wouldn't have to negotiate, you know, even VMware doesn't want to spend money on lawyers, right? So if we can find a way to make it easier for them, I think it'll benefit everybody.
I think that's one question from the article. We asked, who is going to be the demand aggregator? You know, how are we going to aggregate? So Richard's here in Australia. They've got that figured out. We've caught it down there. I think the answer is increasingly clear for us. It's going to be Internet 2. Doesn't mean exclusively Internet 2. There may be some things with our regionals we do, or states, or athletic conferences and such. But I think the main action is going to be Internet 2, and that's great.
Yeah, it was just a thought. I mean, it's not the type of services they're talking about now, but why recreate the wheel and create another group if there's...
Well, I mean, between Nakubo, you know, Nakawa, the lawyers, EDUCAUSE on the policy side, right, and the education side. So if you think about the split that we saw, policy and staff really live in the EDUCAUSE side of the world, right? Identity and the aggregation of services live in the Internet 2 side of the world.
And the big pipes.
And of course, the big pipes don't hurt. So, you know, that helps, in my mind, give us a little bit of definition. But those definitions didn't exist a few years ago, and now they're naturally emerging as a result of you know, everybody's efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Could you go to the microphone, because we are, it's being streamed, or a mic standing over here, and that way the folks out there can hear as well.
I'm Fran Lepresti from the University of Maryland. My question is about, for Internet 2, one of the things that we found in our regional networks is that a networking group, once they start getting into services, they're out of their realm. I mean, networking people think, they think pipes, and we couldn't do what we're doing in cloud without virtualization and broadband. I mean,
right.
Those were the two of the drivers. So what do you know what Internet 2 is doing to bring on staff that work on the rest of the infrastructure? Because those are the people who are thinking about the infrastructure services and who know what the actual issues are.
Well, Dave Lambert, the president of Internet 2, convened a group of CIOs maybe a year ago now.
About a year ago.
Defined a job description for a new vice president of Internet 2, NetPlus Services, a scope of that portfolio. They are operating it differently than the network side, just interrelated. I think your point is really valid, though. You know, everything looks like a nail if all you have is a hammer, or the other way around, right? So I think this is something that is an issue. But the Internet 2 networking team is not the NetPlus team.
Right.
You know, the NetPlus team has, you know, our identity architects, the people that built the service around In Common. That is the largest federation. You know, it's already there. But not only that, the relationships now between those communities and the regional networks are going to be critical, because the regional networks are also offering services. So what are they doing at scale, and how do we expose those services to the broader community where they're working well, so that a regional can get out of some businesses and be really good in other businesses, or the national can get out of, you know, I mean, those lines of definition are totally different than they were 5 years ago with just the network layer or the infrastructure layer. Right?
But I think this is an important point. Our regional optical networks are very important. I manage one in Indiana, but there's no rational economic reason to believe that Indiana's iLight doing a deal with Box.net or with HP for cycles and storage, that that is the optimal point of negotiation and aggregation, because it would be no different than Merit in Michigan needing to do one of those, or Learn. You know, that's the kind of thing that it does scale on up to the national level. So I do think our regional networks ought to think carefully about what they can do at pace that really benefits their members, or where something really ought to be kicked on up to the Net Plus division at Internet 2. And this is a whole new venture of Internet 2 that Dave Lambert is staffing properly, and off we go.
Yeah, we've been providing that guidance to Dave for the last year since he took over Internet 2, that, you know, it's not your same old network. If you're going to do this, you got to do it differently.
And I think some of the, maybe we're almost out of time here, but I want to be crystal clear on this too. All of this activity, this is not just for the Research One elephants. This is for our entire community. And if anything, I think some of our smaller institutions may be some of the greatest beneficiaries of being able to just tap into the scale of these things that are being created.
So last question over here.
Yeah, one of our online participants wanted to know if you have to be a member of I2 to actually tap into the services.
Yeah, the way it's being structured right now is if you're a member of In Common, so you can use your federated identity, you can get access to the services. They're all limited to .edu, right? So they're all educational right now. That's the way they're structured. Beyond that, if you're an Internet 2 member as well as an In Common member, then you get an additional discount, because that's where the money has come from to support the original Internet 2 investment. So basically, services are available to everybody in Common, and then you get an additional discount if you're also an Internet 2 member.
Good.
Okay, I think that's a wrap. Brad and I are available to take any questions here at the back of the room afterwards. Thank you all very much.